Thank you. I know. Hey girl, how are you? And actually, something she was in second year, she started to
Good evening, everyone. My name is Kamal Johnson. I'm a First Ward Alderman here in Hudson. I want to thank everyone for being here tonight. One of the things that we wanted to do when hosting this event is make sure that our congressman hears from the people that are being affected by a housing issue. It's different when we get statistics and different things like that than when you hear a person's story and then you can put a face to that story. You know, we are both ingrained and wanting to help our communities, and this is something that's very important. This is not a political event. This is just a moment for us to hear from the constituents on issues. We reached out to the congressman when he was running 2 years ago and spoke to him on our radio show, which is in the back, some of the people there. And one of the things that the congressman told us was that he didn't just want to be a figurehead. He wanted to be someone who is actually coming up with solutions and pushing things forward. So we're very excited to have the congressman here. So I want to introduce Antonio Delgado.
Thank you, Kamal. I really appreciate the introduction, the kind words, and your leadership and dedication to the people. I also want to, we have a lot of folks who are local electeds here. I'm just going to say a general acknowledgement and thank you to all the local electeds who are here. I really appreciate you coming out. I do want to acknowledge Michael for the work as well in organizing this, so thank you, sir. And I want to thank all of you for coming here. It's a very important conversation that needs to happen. Just to sort of back up so you understand what I am tasked with representing in terms of this congressional district. There are 11 counties that make up this district. Columbia County is one of those counties, but you also have Dutchess, you have Rensselaer County, you have Sullivan County, you have Ulster County, Greene, Otsego, Delaware, Broome, Schoharie, Montgomery, and there's a bunch of different counties in play here. And it's about 8,000 square miles. It's one of the most rural seats of any Democrat in Congress, in the eighth in the entire country. And it is vast. But I've tried to make it a point as a new member of Congress to get out there and to connect with every community, particularly the communities who have been far too often pushed to the margins, and far too often neglected, and far too often exploited in a system that I believe has runaway levels of inequity and injustice. And it is imperative that the folks who end up in Washington to do the work of the people never lose sight of the people. And the only way that can happen is to come speak to the people and listen to the people. I've done 23 town halls, 2 in every one of the 11 counties, all throughout this district. And I make sure to go everywhere to connect and listen and hear from you directly. Now this week, I have focused on affordable housing. You know, when you're in Washington, you only get to come home for an entire week period, 1 week a month. We call that an in-district work period. And then you're pretty much there Monday through Thursday in Washington. You come home on the weekends. So I really try to take as much time as I can when I'm home during the week, during that in-district work week, to tackle the issues on the ground, to hear from the community. That's why I have locally based advisory councils in the veteran space, in the ag space, in the healthcare space, in the small business space, trying to stay connected. Because I can tell you, you get to Washington, you got a lot of folks that shake your hand and smile in your face, pat you on the back, and make you feel real important about yourself. And you can lose sight of who you represent and who you serve. That's a big reason why, you know, I don't take corporate PAC money. It's a big reason why I make it a point to stay connected to the community. Now, on that note, as I have traveled across the district, focusing on housing, focusing on affordability, focusing on the federal funding that must be utilized to support housing, not just to fix up housing, but also build new housing, and includes services beyond affordability of housing as well. And also, critical issue, protecting tenants' rights and ensuring that tenants are not victimized by expressing their concerns about their conditions that they're living in. And nobody, irrespective of your income bracket, needs to be feeling like they live in a cage or feeling like their freedom of movement is limited. And it is important that you see in me an advocate in this space. And I get it. I understand that a lot of politicians can come through and say all types of stuff in a moment, and then that's it. So I'm not coming here expecting you to just trust everything I have to say. I know there's a process to this, and I have to earn that. I have to continue to work with you, continue to listen to you, continue to figure out how I can help in Washington. But at the same time, I'll tell you something too. I don't spin. I talk straight. And I try to make it clear, we have a tough, tough hill to climb ahead of us. The stacks, or the chips, I should say, are stacked against us. In a very, very high way, and they've been so for a long time. I'll give you one example. Right now, African Americans can purchase 55% of all the available homes on the marketplace. Their counterparts, white Americans, can purchase 80%. And there are racial disparities and gaps. But even beyond the racial disparities and gaps, right now in this country, right now, half of all households, white, black, brown, are sharing 1.3% of all the wealth. Half of all households, 1.3% of all the wealth. Two-thirds of folks in this country are living paycheck to paycheck. 2 out of every 3 people, okay, in this country. So when I say that the stacks are high, the chips are stacked against us, I mean it. But the benefit of trying to utilize what we have in government for the betterment of the people is why I'm here. And I'm happy to talk about affordable housing. I'm happy to talk about anything else. But I will highlight a couple of things that I've learned. One, there are programs that are meant to help provide more and more funding, whether it's low-income or affordable housing tax credits, which I think can be more utilized, whether it's
putting more of a cushion in Section 8 so that it actually can meet the gap. Because what I'm hearing from folks is, even if you have a job per se, that job is ultimately, Kamal shared this earlier, you could have a worker looking for work, you could find work, and then by getting that job, you end up being forced into the marketplace. In the marketplace, you're priced out of. The gap between remaining relatively unemployed and being able to sustain yourself in that space and then getting out with employment but having to figure out how to survive in a marketplace where the rents are running wild is just too big. There's no way to close the gap without assistance. Without assistance and without regulations that make sure that when developers come in and utilize their capital, they're doing so in a way that stabilizes the rent, that doesn't push people out. We need more stringent conditions on the ways in which capital is invested in the community. And that's a role that the federal government can play, and I intend to play. And I also intend to really make a point to focus on how we can protect tenant rights. You should feel comfortable voicing your opinions. You should feel comfortable having the capacity and the resources to take action, to take legal recourse. The stats right now, the fact is we have so much imbalance between those who are with the means to defend themselves compared to those who are the victims. And so we have to do a better job of government to promote that general welfare, to provide that security level. And we're not doing that right now. Now, I could sit up here and talk all night, but I didn't come here for that. I really came here to hear directly from you about your concerns, about your issues. And I want to be able to take that in and not just answer your questions, but also process whatever you give me so that when I go back to Washington, we can do the work. And I'll just close on this. We do the work. There's a lot of ugliness out there right now. A lot of hate, a lot of division, a lot of divisiveness, a lot of nastiness, a lot of racial provocation, a lot of stuff that needs to stop. But in this district, for those who don't know, is 90% white. Okay? One-third independent, one-third Republican, one-third Democrat. And for those who don't know, if you didn't watch TV or turn on a YouTube ad or Facebook last couple years, I used to be a hip-hop artist. And that was used against me when I ran. Meant to pit me against the community. And the assumption was, well, if we could just paint him this way, no way in the world a district that's 90% white and rural is going to vote for him. No way in the world. That was the assumption. Well, it didn't work. Didn't work. Because everybody got out and connected. Everybody had a human-to-human contact and experience. And when you talk from the heart and when you speak and you genuinely care about people, that goes a long way to overcome the differences. We've introduced 16 bills since I've been in the House, out of my office. 12 of those bills have been bipartisan bills. That means we can find alliances on the other side of the aisle, which is not easy to do in this environment. And I have one bill that actually got signed, wait for it, by the president. All right. So there's opportunities there. It's not easy, but I'm here to work with you, listen to you, and go from there. So from there, I'm happy to open it up for questions. And I will note we're trying to focus on housing in particular. So I prefer if we can keep it in that lane. But I do understand that if folks have other issues, that's fine. But love to kind of try to keep it in the lane of affordability housing, particularly because that's the focus. Yes?
I'm sorry that I want to speak first, but I have to leave pretty quick. So I just want to make people aware of, well, make you aware too, if you're not already, aware of an opportunity for affordable housing that a lot of people are not really aware of. And that is that HUD, some years back, changed the definition of family. It used to be that to define a family, HUD definition of family was people that were related by blood, marriage, or other workings of law. Well, some years ago, HUD, for various reasons, changed that definition to say that any one or more people who say they're a family are a family. So you and I could come into this office and say we're family and look for an apartment, providing we meet the income guidelines and whatever other screening criteria they have, Tim knows this, it's true. So, with that being said, there are also different tiers of affordable housing. There's extremely low, there's very low, and there's low. This, I believe, falls under the low. This falls under the low, which means one person making about possibly $27,000 a year would qualify to live here, or the low rise, or Schuyler Court, or Hudson Terrace. In fact, I think Hudson Terrace, I know for a fact they used to have higher income limits, they used to be the higher of that, but that may have changed. Two people don't double it. It's not 27 and 27. It's more like 30,000 for two people. So a lot of people that feel like they are, and when you get to that income limit, your rent would be 30% of your 30% of your income. So a lot of people who feel that they are kind of shut out might find that they're not. If you're single, you would, might still qualify. You don't have to be married. You don't have to have children. I think the only places that you can't is places that are specifically mentioned for elderly and disabled housing, such as Providence Hall, but I'm not even 100% sure about that. Anyway, I have the income guidelines if anybody is interested in seeing them for Columbia County specifically. And I know people say, oh, there's long waiting lists, but the truth of the matter is if you don't apply, you're never going to get called. So just want to put that out there for anybody who didn't know that already.
No, I think it's very important that the resources that are available and the information that is available needs to be sought out. I think, you know, to the extent that we can continue to highlight through our office opportunities, and we do have an office in Hudson. So, you know, if you are looking for assistance in terms of being guided to where you can find these resources, and you're trying to figure out, you know, what the avenues are for you, what the options are, then by all means, seek out my staff. Where's Zach? Is Zach here? Because he works out of the Hudson office. There's Zach right there, so you can put a name to a face. Okay? It matters that we do the work on the ground and have the ability to have you come in and connect. So that's a big deal for us. And I thank you for sharing that information. Yes?
Thank you for coming, Mr. Delgado, to this small little community. My husband and I are homeowners, and we recently found out, I'm just talking property tax, it rolls on us $10,000 in 1 year. Now, in order for us to cover that, we would have to, one of us would have to pick up another job because our job is not increasing. We've gotten some assistance. We're now currently taking it where we had to get an attorney to go to court, which isn't included. Also, school taxes, which rolls this year, adding that rolls, the kids probably wouldn't have a football team or a basketball team. Now, in a situation like that, my husband and I were still young, but younger than homeowners, and it was affordable. Now, we have people who are extremely wealthy moving in, and when they ask us to compare the property, the two homes that was kind of a bit available for us to compare, those houses have invested over $200,000 within one shot. We actually went and asked when the renovation was being done, how much is that house going on the market for? And the guy told us like $450,000. I'm like, what? And I said to my husband, this is going to affect us, but my question is for homeowners. And the same day the city sent out their assessment was the same exact day that a realtor sent us a letter stating that, hey, we just sold a house across from your street. And this is how, we didn't ask anyone that we wanted to get out of this city. We built here, we raised our child here, we have family here. So what gives the city, and why isn't there a limit on why the mayor, when I've gone to meeting, I've heard aldermen and alderwomen said they had pushed towards the mayor to tell him three times to veto the bill that this wouldn't happen. And it, personally, in plain words, it seemed like no one cared. So now my husband and I, who's gonna give us that $10,000 in property taxes, which is due starting this month, and then school taxes, which I don't even know how much that has gone. How do you handle that at your level?
Well, that's a great question. And
my wife, by the way. That's
quite a husband. Well, a couple things that you flagged, and I might be able to give you to some degree, for some of this, a satisfactory answer, and to another degree, a not so satisfactory answer. On the first piece about home ownership and how we can provide more programming to ease the costs associated, the local property, all the taxes that are associated with it, how do we help homeowners deal with that? There's a lot of federal programs right now that are designed, and I mentioned this, the low-income tax credit, for example. There's a lot of credits that are designed to help investment in rental buildings, but there aren't as many federal programs designed to provide tax credits in a meaningful way for homeowners. And I think if we do a better job in the federal government devising a tax scheme that enables young homeowners, particularly homeowners who aren't wealthy, an ability to earn credit towards their home, that can alleviate some of the more local dynamics that are ongoing on the ground. That's the satisfactory part, but it's related to the unsatisfactory part in that part of why the dynamics on the ground are what they are and they're local, federal government can only do so much, right, to really get its hands in what's happening with private actors and local officials when it comes to the purchase of property and the sale of property. I mean, we don't have that kind of reach to get that far down. Now, I will say what we can do when it comes to capital investment, when it comes to corporations or developers who are looking make a robust investment in order to gentrify ultimately the community. I think to the extent any of that funding that is being used by those private actors for that purpose, we can tie some real strings to that and say any funds that you are relying on for the purpose of buying property or buying housing in a community must be utilized in such a way that it doesn't ultimately have the effect of pricing individuals out of the community. And I think we don't do a good enough job of that at the federal level. We kind of let the marketplace do what it wants and don't really think about the effect of that on the communities at risk. So that's more of an indirect way to handle the situation, not as direct. I can't reach down to the local community per se and say, you need to do this, you need to do that. That's not my job, right? But my job is to, as part of the member of Congress, to figure out what regulations that we can put in place that have an ultimate downstream effect on behavior at the state and the local level. Does that make sense?
No, it makes sense. I appreciate your answer, but we're still, my husband and I went and applied, to get the taxes reduced, we were denied. I gave them over 30 some odd pictures of mold that was in the house, and they were like, oh, this place doesn't even look like it's inhabitable. I said, no, we need to live here. And then they turned and said, we find it satisfactory, you don't have enough proof. But who should we go to? There were 350 people that filed grievances because their taxes went up. No, we went from 164,000 to 362,000. That's not feasible for anyone to and that's just an assessment. It doesn't mean we're going to sell the property and get that.
Right.
We're just paying the tax. But locally, what can people like myself in this room do that is dealing with this? Who can we go to?
Right.
To
Well, you got some local folks in here. I'm pretty
sure. Folks have been fighting. And the mayor, I'm blunt, I'm not a whatever, he turned it down when the aldermen and alderwomen spoke out. He vetoed it three times.
Right. And I think, ultimately, this is why engagement matters, and this is why it's important to hold your elected officials accountable. Right? It's important to ensure that if, in your estimation, someone is not responding in the way they need to be responding, then you act appropriately. You seek, whether it's engaged through the voting booth, or whether it's engaging with the other electeds, or whether it's engaging with local community or other organizations, you have to stay engaged in that fight, in that process. And that's how it works. I mean, this is happening at the federal level. I mean, there's things that we want to do at the federal level that, because of the current administration, right? I mean, our hands are tied in a lot of respects. You know, we have a person in the White House who doesn't believe in climate change. So if I care about the environment, I care about trying to figure out how to protect the environment, well, it's kind of hard to have that conversation with somebody who doesn't believe in the science of climate change. Right? So there's only so much, you know, you can do when the power is set. And so that's where the power of the people comes into play. It's only the power of the people can change the status quo, right? Can reshuffle the dynamics. And so to me, that's part of the answer, is staying engaged, utilizing every bit of leverage you have, to stay on top of your local actors, and of course, get out there and participate in the system. Yes, sir.
So Congressman, the thing that they brought up about the tax assessment was the talk to the assessment board, but also this would have to do with you with your the person that served before you voted to eliminate SALT. SALT is going to be a direct effect of families like that where they no longer can now write that tax off. But I want to go to the tax credits. You have buildings like this that are voucher based, right? And it goes to what Kamal was saying, as your income goes up, your rent will go up. But when you guys give out federal tax credits, there is a very short window for federal tax credits, much shorter than the state even. And so that makes it, one, highly competitive. And then you have people who are looking to do affordable housing, and a lot of times they lose out to what you were just describing, some people that want to be in the more affluent areas and develop more housing. So I think it would be imperative, one, if we were to try to expand that window so it was more broad for people who were going to do affordable housing projects, but two, if they weren't, who would do what you were just saying, is put clawbacks in or put mandatory actions in there so that they have to do something like an 80-20 project or a 70-30.
Right. No, I totally agree with you. And I want to, because your first point, and I want to make sure, maybe I didn't hear the way you framed the question appropriately. Were you saying that you were paying more than $10,000 in property taxes?
My taxes got increased within 1 year, just property, over $10,000.
So that's what I want to make sure I understand, because the cap that was, thank you for flagging, I didn't hear that you were paying more now over $10,000, because the cap is set at $10,000, right? So anything you pay, obviously, is going to be a problem on top of that. And what happened with the tax bill was that it created a cap. So you can only tax up to up to $10,000, right? That was the law. That's the law now under the books. The bill, the law before that in 2016 was there was no cap. You could deduct all of your property taxes, because otherwise you'd be being double taxed. You get the state tax taxing, and then you get the federal tax, and that's double taxation, right? So you're right. I didn't fully appreciate that. What you're saying is that you actually now beyond the cap, which is ultimately going to result in your inability to actually deduct. And on that point, we're all over that. We have written a letter to the president. I've introduced legislation to roll back that cap, and that's hopefully going to be introduced in the House. Now, I will tell you something that, you know, on this, we're talking about a divided government, right? So getting it through the same Republican Senate that voted for it, more or less, in the first place, is going to be tough. But we do have a democratically controlled House, and with that democratically controlled House, we were able to introduce a bill that would roll back that cap and provide real relief for you. And on this tax bill, which to me gets to the heart of the issue here, we got folks hurt. We got 40-plus million people in poverty. Homeless, struggling, kids, you know, trying to get by. We have people who are really hurting. And the notion that we're going to do a tax bill that is essentially a giveaway to individuals of high net worth and big corporations, and it's paid for, on this point, it was in part paid for by creating the cap. They had to figure out where can we pay for it. The brakes, and not for the high net worth individuals and for the big corporations. And the way to do that was to create a cap for individuals. And that was about as inequitable and about as unjust as you can do. So we're working on trying to roll that back.
But my question is, you stated before that it's within the local body that would have to deal with it. So why did the local body went and increased? I'm not the only one that I've heard people that said, I mean,
I can't tell you why a local body, I can't give you that answer. I wish I could tell you why people do what they do locally. I can tell you why I do things. And I can speculate based on my role in Washington, why Washington does things, because I have proximity and I understand. And I can, but for me to try to opine on why an individual in a local community acts a certain way, that's it's a tough task.
Because at the end of the day, if it's $10,000, you're going to have to pay them. Even if you do it as a tax write-off, they're going to need it every quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And where do we get that money from? That's my standpoint. Not just me, for all the other 349 homeowners
right.
who fell in that bracket. Where do we get the money from?
Well, my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I know that the state has been working to try to figure out how to mitigate the effects, you know, of the federal tax bill and the cap. I don't know how much coordination there has been at the state level, you know, with the local levels. I know it's unclear what ultimately has been devised in a way that's going to be a real solution. But listen, I hear you, and I understand this is a tough situation to be in. And I can tell you what I'm doing on my level is to do my best to roll this cap back. Yes?
Yeah, this is a question about rental
housing. Yes.
I don't know, you probably know, the statistics in Columbia County of the availability of affordable housing,
yeah.
which is the need. My sense is the need outweighs the availability.
Yeah.
I live now in Crosswinds, which is an affordable housing complex that was built with state tax credits. And I mean, clearly, I operate from a position of privilege, so it's easy for me to navigate some stuff that it might not be as easy for other people. I don't have children. I don't present problems, but I could not afford to live in Hudson until I got that apartment. I have a friend now who's in a similar income situation that I'm in. I live on Social Security, and I have a little bit of employment part-time. But I have a friend who's looking for an apartment in Hudson because the place she lives is really uninhabitable, although believe me, there's plenty of people in Hudson who live in that kind of housing. And she's paying double what I pay for nowhere near the kind of amenities and the kind of unit that I have. And I become a big fan of this tax credit, affordable housing. This is a small city, but we need more of that in the county.
Well, listen, I answer you. So on the last point, the tax credit, affordable housing piece, we just, you know, co-sponsored the bill that would expand the credit by 50% and 30% even more on top of that within the rural community. So we're and for incentivizing more investment. But that's just one piece to the puzzle. You know, how we define affordability, right? I mean, because we were talking earlier with some folks on this issue about, you know, the metric, area median income, right, the AMI, right? And how that is used to sort of benchmark what's affordable. But what we're finding, particularly in this area, is that as you have more and more wealthy individuals on the very high end of the income bracket moving into an area, it skews the sort of reliability of AMI. And it doesn't really tell the whole story of how low the low end goes.
And that's what the rent is based on, and that's what the...
Yes, that sets the level. So, and I'm talking with folks who are going to be looking into the way, and there are a lot of folks who are really invested in this, and I was in communication with them about what we can do to put a bit more specificity on how we actually get to this, and not look at it so macro and use sort of this sort of oversimplified way to break it down. You know, in Otsego County, and I'm sure there's a similar situation here, but somebody gave me a stat out there that more than 55% of all the folks in that county are utilizing more than 30% of their income to pay for rent. Think about that, more than 30%. Now they say, you know, really, you want to, we don't even want to get more than 25, really.
I'm close to 50.
You're close to 50, right? So that is the real benchmark, right? And how do we get to a place that we can measure how many people in a community are really able to afford housing in a way that's really a quarter of their income per se, right, for example. So that's the thing that's not being done right now, and it's, we have to fix that.
Crosswinds is out on the boulevards. One time, that was the suburbs of Hudson, you know. And there's a transportation problem. Give me, Michael, if we never finish that conversation. But there's a bus, the county bus, that runs between the city and out there. So people can go shopping, because there's no real shopping, food shopping in Hudson. And also people can work out there. There's a whole bunch of stores. The problem with this bus is it quits going at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So you can't, if you go to work or you go to shop from Hudson, you can't get back home. You can't get a cab at certain hours of the day. Plus, and it's vice versa. It's both ways. If I need to come into Hudson, it's the same thing. I got to go home at 1 o'clock. You know, if I have a doctor's appointment, whatever. And so I really think that combined with, because more people could have better jobs if they had more mobility.
I hear you, and I serve on three committees in Washington. I serve on the Agriculture Committee, the Small Business Committee, and the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. And that last one speaks to your issue, and I've spoken to the chairman about what I can really own as a member of the committee, a lowly first-year member. And I made a very strong case that I think, looking at the dynamics in my district, that one thing besides broadband access and a host of other things, cell service, but public transportation is of critical importance. And there's ways we can do this, not even just with buses per se. You know, some folks were telling me earlier this week that there used to be a program that was supported through state and federal funding through programs like community block grants and that work on wheels, where they would take old automobiles, you know, fix them up, and you know, sell them at an incredible discount, if not give them away in some cases, and provide individuals automobiles to get from point A to point B. It costs, for two buses, about $1 million. Back when this program was working, for $1 million, you could have put 200 people in cars and to work. So, you know, that. So these are the kind of programs that we could be thinking about implementing. And that's the kind of conversation that I take back with me to Washington when I think about what can we really do to make an impact on the ground. I see, do you have your hand up? Here, why don't you come up here, because I want you, this is important, I have folks here.
We have pamphlets for everyone here as renters to learn about your rights, and there's also a youth-led housing forum this Saturday at the Hudson Library, 3:30 to 5, where me, myself, am going to tell my story about my difficulty with housing and how that's still affecting me now. And you all can also speak, and Delgado will be there to hear your stories. So that's my announcement. And I have a question for you. So like here in Hudson, it's like for people of low income and people who don't make enough money to live here, they have to leave and, you know, they can't live here. So do you think like there should be a limit on like, if you make too much, you can't live here? If you, because people don't make enough to live here. So like, if you can make too much to live here, that would make sense.
So first I want to applaud Mia. We met earlier. She came to a stakeholder meeting about affordable housing and, you know, had no problem with all the quote-unquote bigwigs sitting right in that conversation and being a voice, and I appreciate that. A sophomore, right?
Yeah.
A sophomore in high school. So I really just want to take a moment to applaud your level of engagement, and I want to encourage you to keep it up. Now, on your very good question, and you can always count on young people to ask the best questions. Here's the thing. And this is kind of what I was getting at earlier about how much we can do at the state level. It's a delicate balance between what we call capitalism and democracy. Capitalism, which I believe in, is a free market enterprise system that encourages and spurs economic growth by incentivizing people to take chances and risks and to innovate, and you get all types of inventions as a result. We all can benefit over time. If we have a well-functioning democracy that reflects the will of the people, and that will then has the effect of properly regulating the marketplace. That's the way it's meant to work. And so what your question gets at, in some respects, is private actors are going to do what they're going to do. Right? If they want to purchase land and they want to buy a property, there's a way in which they can do that. And you know, there are limited instances where the government can step in and take property and the domain, all types of things. There are limited ways, but for the most part, you know, that's an individual market enterprise. Problem is, we've allowed this to happen, right, to such a degree, and we've turned a blind eye to do anything to counterweight it, to figure out, okay, well, if this is going to be the case, you know, but again, this is the federal level. Like, this is different what the state and local actors do. But what can we do to at least offset the impact of that? So one example, and somebody mentioned this at the last meeting, you were there, right? Rent stabilization, right? So if you say that a community is going to have their rent stabilized for an extended period of time, as people move into the area, one, they have to figure out if they want to move into the area, because their objective, particularly if they're high net worth individuals or entities, they really want to move in to elevate the, in their mind, elevate the value of the surrounding property, price people out, get more folks in. But if you can't get out in front of that and stabilize the rent in the area so that even when folks move in, they don't see necessarily the surrounding value of the property increase in where they would desire, it disincentivizes folks from making those decisions, right? So that's one way. That's one way. The other way is, again, as I noted earlier, to the extent these developers are relying on federal dollars to for their credits or for ways to, you know, bundle resources for the purchase of buying property, then we can really get more involved in that and say, well, you can't use these federal dollars unless, you know, you use it in this form or fashion. And I think that's what the government has to do more of when it comes to ensuring that we can maintain the integrity of a community.
But even if they do that, like if we were to make more housing units and everything, all that would happen and they'd be like, well, 10% of the housing units would be for low income. Now if there's 10 housing units, that means only one apartment is good for low income. So
right, and that's why you have to be more demanding of the allocation. It's all related, right? It's not, oh, let's use the current playbook. The current playbook is messed up. Okay, so I hear your response, and your response is based on what you've seen, right? And sort of how it's unfolded in the past. Makes a lot of sense. You're based on what you've experienced. I'm saying, we gotta change the playbook. We gotta write some new plays in the book and make sure that, okay, fine, but we're gonna up the ante here. You know, we're going to not just make sure you live by the current regs, but we're also going to say, actually, this 10% thing doesn't make a lot of sense, given the nature of the community and given the desires of the people. Why don't we figure out a more rational, more just way to go about this? Make sense?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. Yes.
My name is Tiffany
Garriga.
I'm one of the oldest.
Does anybody not know who Tiffany is? Just want to make sure.
I just have a question for you. Particularly, this building is public housing, which is also considered federal property. For many years, there's been issues in this building as far as leakage from the roof that creates mold, which creates a conversation of displacement. Are they going to help us? Are they going to put us out? Where are we going? Are they building new to put other folks and kick us out? There's a lot of conversation around it, which ultimately is fear. So I believe, and through other studies that we found, that this building can be rehabilitated. And through your federal office, is there some way that you can help us to fix the roof so it can stop the leakage spreading through the building? That way they can focus on the mold and taking care of that step by step, rather than creating a more of a housing crisis than what we have in the city of Hudson, not just in the second floor.
Yes, I mean, I think to really get to the question specifically, you know, as it pertains to federal funds that can be used to restore and repair federal buildings, you know, or public housing, then the answer is yes in a sort of simple way. The question really though is ultimately the how and sort of all the different mechanisms in place that can bring that about, particularly when there are competing interests all across the country who are experiencing the same dynamics. And so while I can sit here and say, yes, you should be able to seek this kind of funding, it's one thing to say that in theory, but in practice, you know, we can try, right? And we can work, and you should work with our office, as you do, right, to figure out the ways in which we can help facilitate that conversation and highlight the needs of the community and highlight the needs of Bliss, right, and do that work. But it's going to take a lot of work. And it's making sure that we are, in the end of the day, this is about a zero-sum game. And that's the frustrating part. There are so many the amount of resources that are being divvied up for folks who are struggling is shrinking. It's shrinking. And so these programs that are meant to help, you know, create a safety net for folks to get back on their feet and move forward, and, you know, the net is being shredded. The resources for these types of programs, HUD's funding, you know, has more or less been cut, you know, for the last 20, 30, it hasn't increased, it's been going down. So think about that, right? As the need is increasing, the funding to enable and to sustain the need or to address the need more appropriately is declining.
Can you tell us why it's declining when this is not just it's an across the nation issue? It's not just New York.
A couple reasons why. And listen, this predates, to be clear, the current administration. Okay? This is a trend. And in some cases, you can make the argument that this trend, for some people, is why they support the current president. For some. You could make this argument. And here's the trend. The trend is, for the past 40-some-odd years, more and more money has been pouring into the system. And more elected officials are being bought and paid for by corporate outside special interest groups. And because of that, the will of the people, particularly those folks who don't have the means to go and write a big check for an elected official, they gotta put food on their table and pay their rent, they're the ones now who are being squeezed out of the system. And then you have Citizens United, Supreme Court decision, 2012, was it? That ultimately says, you know what, we're going to lift the cap off and you can just give whatever you like. Unlimited amounts of money. Pour it in the system. Create these nice super PACs and don't even tell us who's giving the money. Don't have to do that. Just pour it in. And so what ends up happening is the system gets corrupted by money. And the folks who get the ear of Congress are the folks who have the means and the capacity to get it. And that's why, like I said at the beginning, I don't deal with corporate PACs. Because I don't want to be put in a position where I find myself beholden to anybody except for you. That's the point, is to be beholden to the folks that I serve. And until we do some real work in our system with putting power back to the people, whether it's making sure we strive more towards publicly financed campaigns, whether it's also making it easier for folks to vote, that's the other way to counterweight this, right? Automatic registration, big deal. A holiday for election day. So if you're working two, three jobs, and you got kids, you got to think about childcare, how about make it easy for folks to go vote? You know, we call ourselves a democracy, but we should act like it. We got voter suppression going on. We got tactics that are being used where people say, oh, well, you didn't vote last cycle, we're going to take your name off the rolls. Well, we're going to forward you some mail that we can't forward back to us, and then if you don't respond to it, we're going to take you off the rolls. These are ongoing nationwide practices on state levels that are handcuffing the will of the people. And that is why we are where we are, and why so many people feel like the government no longer works for them. That's the reality. And you can have that feeling no matter where you really fall on the political spectrum in the current climate. And that's the problem.
But you work for us.
Well, that's what I'm here to do.
And I just want to encourage anyone who is sitting here today that has fear of speaking up, which is understandable, reach out to me and we will go to Delgado's office together.
Absolutely. And again, like I said at the top of this, you know, I'm here to, in some respects, break the, you know, the
cycle.
The cycle. Thank you. Thank you. I'm here to try to inject a new way. And it's not easy. I'm not going to sit here and act like it's easy. You know, the system is entrenched when it comes to its dysfunction and its partisanship and the money in the system. And that's just the truth. But there's something about people and the power of people that always gives democracy a chance. Always. And it's just about making sure that we stay engaged. And I'm here where I'm here because of that. That's what happened in 2018. Yeah, I found, okay. Yes, I see you, sir. But now your wife, so we're gonna. Okay.
My name is Miss Glenda. Everybody knows me,
yes,
really.
Thank
you for coming. I have a question, and I also had owned my own home, and the taxes was eaten up for me. But I downsized, and I went into an apartment, but the apartment was also not affordable. So I got a roommate, but the roommate wasn't trying to pay their half to get back to. I came back into this building. This is where I came out of to buy my home. But with God's will, they let me come back into this building. But now they're giving me Section 8 so I can go out and find another apartment. That's a very hard task because everything is over what they're allowing me to have. I mean, what am I supposed to do? Go get another job and try to... I mean, I'm getting older. I downsized everything so I can live off the land, really, to be honest. And they're giving me an allowance where I can get a one-bedroom apartment, but each and every apartment that I look for and look at is over what they're telling me. And then if it's not over what they're telling me, it's at that mark. And I have to pay my own lights and gas and electricity.
That's the key piece right
now,
there you just mentioned.
Now, in this building right here, I don't have to pay those things. So it has me frazzled where, do you think I'm really going to go back out there and try that again?
I'm being honest. I hear you.
And I'm not going to get another job to pay for it.
Right.
So what do people do besides, and can I give my Section 8 to somebody else who I believe in?
That's just
starting
out. No, but I hear you. Here's what I'll say. So the Section 8 piece, this is tied to, again, affordability and how HUD defines affordability, and importantly, how HUD, which, by the way, for those who don't know, is currently overseen by Ben Carson. This is the same individual who said that poverty is a state of mind. That's his outlook on the situation. The Section 8 piece is impacted by the fact that when HUD assesses or issues its report and says, here's fair market value for properties, and you just hit the nail on the head. For example, they don't even include utilities in that calculation. So what ends up happening is that report gets released, And then private renters in the community who you're trying to engage with say, ah, good. Now we have a benchmark and we'll just, you know, elevate from there. So at the, from again, from the federal level, what we need to be doing is leveling it down to the best of our abilities to, in essence, close that gap and to increase the support with Section 8 to meet the gap. And I think if we do both of those things, the top end and from the bottom end, we can get there.
Now, my other question is this. Now, I live here, and if they want security and they also want first month rent, now Section 8 pays for that. And if the rent is $900, I live in subsidized housing. Where I'm getting $900 to give to them? Or I heard that they want first and last month rent, but they stopped doing that. But I'm saying to myself, if I'm living really check to check and in subsidized housing, where do I get that money for my security?
Right. No, yeah, listen, I think that you're painting the picture of the dilemma and how we have to do a lot more work to cover that gap. We're not doing enough. We're not focusing on the gap. And that's the bigger point to all this. This is not an issue that is being thought about enough. You know, we haven't done any real investment in housing in this country in 30-plus years. 30-plus, we haven't really done any meaningful, robust national program to address the cost of housing, all the despite the fact we are in the middle of a housing crisis. You know, we talk a lot about climate change, for example. That's a big deal. It's a big deal. And you can see people trying to rally around the cause, rightfully so. We need to marshal that same sort of support when it comes to the crisis, because we're talking about upward mobility. Yes. You know, if you don't have a home, if you don't have a place that you can, that you're secure in, there's no way to elevate yourself. There's no way to improve not just your condition, but your children's. Yes. You know, how can you go look for a job if you have no place to come home to? If you got to worry about where you're going to sleep that night, it's hard to figure out, oh, here's where I need to go to find a job. Once you get to home, then you can start building. Then you can start reaching out and figuring out, what are my options in this community? Where can I find work? And you build from there. And we're ripping that away from folks right now. And as a result, people are just floating and don't have any real sense of anchor in where they are. But there's a lot of unrest and unease in what the future might hold. We got to change that dynamic. Now, I'm going to do one more question, because I know... Oh, yes, yes, sir. All right, but I saw you earlier, and I did promise you I would answer your question. I think I actually answered your question, but go ahead. All right.
I seen a report that stated that in 5 years, the community, the age of the community is going to be 60 and older. So as the kids evolve and go off to school and come back and can't afford to start their own household, what can be put in place in terms of like kind of like balancing that you know, bringing that balance in terms of industry coming in here,
absolutely,
jobs, so we can balance that.
Well, a lot of it, and this is a story that I hear a lot across the district, we have Asian communities and no generation coming up behind.
Right.
Because of the lack of opportunities and affordability. You know, there are folks who actually are moving up from New York City, for example, looking to do work, finding opportunities, but then they go out into the community and try to find housing, and they realize, I can't afford it, they got to move back. Talk about young people. Talk about people of limited, who are looking to start their careers and start their families, and they're coming here trying to build, and they can't. Then you have folks who grew up here, right, who want to stay in the community. They might even go off, you know, go to college or seek other opportunities. Say, you know what, I got all this experience, I want to bring it back home and invest in my community. And then looking around, they're saying, well, it's hard to do that, right? And part of it is, there's a host of issues when it comes to this. We don't have a lot of reliable building blocks when it comes to how we can generate economic growth. And that starts with some of the building blocks of infrastructure, with roads and rail, transportation, broadband access throughout, you know, quality cell service should be a no-brainer. How do we get to a point where people are able to communicate and sell their goods and services, and how do you spur economic growth, but also work development programs, workforce development programs. How are we generating more economic growth on the ground through apprenticeship programs? They're not assuming that everybody is going off to college. Because we could also get back to, I heard a stat recently, I can go on and on, I got people saying we got, Here's a stat recently.
Let me cut you off. Hold on one second.
The average age of plumbers in certain counties, 60 years old, right? Mechanics, carpenters, these are good paying jobs. You can make a good living with these jobs. We're not educating folks. We're not putting the resources into the community and directing people into these positions. And when, to go back to climate change, the same thing applies. We got jobs that we could be investing in when it comes to weatherization of homes, when it comes to solar paneling. Really good jobs that you can get skilled training for that'll keep folks here, create more business opportunities, incentivize investment in the community. But we're not doing that. Well, I'm trying to do it. And that's why I created or introduced a bill called the Green Jobs Opportunities Act last week, which does exactly, it asks the Department of Energy, where will we need to be with jobs if we want to get to net zero carbon emissions by 2050? If we want to hit that goal, and then identify the gap. Identify what that gap is, and then put a lot of money into community colleges, high schools, and middle schools to develop apprenticeship programs to train young people for those very jobs. Jobs that will keep them in the community and help kill the environment. So, I want to, come on, thank you, sir. I want to thank all of you. It is hot here. I'll tell you that. I really appreciate it. My office is here. We're here in Hudson. I want to do whatever we can to help. Please come by. Reach out to Zach, Amanda, my district director. We want to help. So please make sure you come out and connect with us. Thank you.
Concludes our broadcast.